Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
New Books in Southeast Asian Studies is supported by the Sydney Southeast Asia Centre, building on the expertise of over 300 specialists at the University of Sydney for research, education, and partnerships in Southeast Asia, and by the Griffith Asia Institute, an internationally renowned institution for policy-relevant research on the politics, economics, societies, and cultures of Asia and the Pacific. For more information on their latest activities, please click on the links which you can find on the New Books in Southeast Asian Studies website.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Faiza Zakaria, Assistant Professor of History at Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. I'm delighted to have with me today Shervan Han, Assistant Professor of Malay Studies at the National University of Singapore. Prof Han's book, Sovereign Women in a Muslim Kingdom, The Sultanate of Aceh, 1641 to 1699, is a pioneering inquiry into half a century of rule by queens in the early modern Islamic Kingdom of Aceh. The book draws on both indigenous texts and European sources to analyze how female rule in Aceh was legitimized. It demonstrates gender differences in leadership and shows how female rule can be put in a broader context of queenship in history. Banu, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
It's such a pleasure to have you here.
Nice pleasure to be here.
So before we start on the book discussion proper, could you tell us a little about yourself and your background and how you came to write this book?
My early education was in Singapore. I did my history honours in the history department of the National University of Singapore, continued with the Masters of Arts in the South Asian Studies, and then I sort of ventured abroad and I did my advanced Masters in Leiden University, and finally my PhD at Queen Mary University of London.
And do you have particular turning points or that led you to come to be interested in the topic of female leadership, which is the main subject of this book?
Well, yes, I think it was a very long journey because after my honours in history, I actually started my career and I taught at the JC, and after that, I decided that, you know, I'd like to pursue my studies, and I did my MA. But after my MA, I wasn't sure whether I wanted to do my PhD, but I was reading pre-colonial Southeast Asia, which was something different because in my honours here, now that I was doing generally European history. So while I was reading pre-colonial Southeast Asia, I was really, really struck by the studies of Anthony Reed, Barbara Ndaya, Leonard Ndaya, who studied on pre-colonial Southeast Asia, but also looking at the role of women. So I was quite struck by the idea that women's roles and status in Southeast Asia was high. And I was very curious about that. And also, I think I was first introduced to the queens. So there was a preponderance of queens in Southeast Asia during that particular period. And yet, they were unknown and nothing much was written about them. And sort of the few early readings which I read generally portrayed them in quite a unfavorable light in terms of they were weak and, you know, there was a decline of the kingdoms, especially in Aceh. So I was curious enough and I thought I would like to continue to find out, you know, why and what happened. And Anthony Reed, I would say, would be a mentor to me, and he encouraged me to do more on Aceh. And that was sort of why I more or less focused on this research topic. But in terms of my journey, PhD, I think that was another whole long journey whereby, you know, after my master's, I wanted to do my PhD. And of course, funding was a huge problem. And that was when I met Professor Bluzay from Leiden University. And he told me about the TANAP program, whereby they would encourage scholars from Asia to go to Leiden and to go to The Hague to look at European sources and, of course, here Dutch sources, and to learn these sources and to write their own history, you know, from the sort of a more autonomous perspective. So I applied and all that and managed to get into the TANAP program. And I did my training, got my scholarship, but I did not continue in Leiden. I decided to go to Queen Mary, and I was offered scholarship at Queen Mary, Centre of Editing Letters. And so there was I, you know, doing my PhD and finishing it.
And I think one of the strengths of this book comes up from what you said about sources and the strength of the empirical research and the wide range of sources that you consulted, which includes VOC archives, it also includes travelers' narratives, trade records, Acehnese manuscripts such as Bustanah Salatin and so on. So I was wondering, with such a broad range of sources, what are some of the challenges that you face in tackling them and managing the data? And for manuscript sources especially, how do we separate the literary from the historical, and how do we approach this to create a persuasive historical narrative?
Like I said, I mean, I was, in a way, as a result of the TANAP program, I was anyway tasked to do Dutch sources. So, anyway, that forms a backbone of my PhD thesis. And I think this is where, if you look at sources, the sources have both strengths and limitations. And we need to approach different sources, you know, with a different lens. And in some cases, you will read the sources more carefully against the grain and so on and so forth. So for the Dutch sources, the training was tough. You know, it was a year of paleography and transliterating and then translation. So, you know, so I really owe to the TANAP program for that. And of course, the Dutch sources are very rich, you know, it's voluminous and very rich and very detailed in terms of recording what took place in the courts of Aceh. And of course, other courts as well. So I was concentrating more on the Acehnese court.
Mm-hmm.
So the kinds of sources for the VOC are correspondences from Batavia to Aceh, you know, from the Governor General to the residents and the diplomats who stayed in Aceh for months on end. And also the correspondences from the Dutch governor to the Heeren in 17 in Amsterdam. So that formed quite a huge corpus of the sources. But besides that, there were also the treaties and letters, translated letters, you know, in Dutch on the Malay world. But largely, I would use the dagregisters of the diplomats and the envoys who were sent to Aceh and where they stayed for like 3 months or 4 months. And there they recorded a daily diary of what happened in Aceh, and, you know, like audience days, and when they go to the court, what happened, the kind of discussions they had with the Sultana on audience days and the Orang Kaya and nobility. So that was really, really rich. But of course, that's from a Dutch perspective, and it's really centered on the Dutch and the Dutch activities. And they were very interested on the things that related to them, for example, commerce and treaties and so on and so forth. So we need to approach that with caution as well. We need to look at the people that they were talking about rather than just what interested them. And you have to read sometimes against the grain, you know, the Dutch sources. But in terms of the rich details and the vivid descriptions, I think that was really a strength. And, you know, you could gain much from those Dutch sources. But Dutch sources will give you sort of one perspective. And I think it's very important for us to understand also indigenous sources, because indigenous sources will give you the worldviews, the kind of normative values about, you know, whether they are describing the sultanates as in the court chronicles, the Bustan al-Salatin, for example, or when they talk about, let's say, the exploits of certain sultans, the Hikayat Aceh, for example. You get sort of a rich corpus of material in terms of the symbols, the myths, the worldviews, and so on. Back to your question in terms of how do you separate myths from historical facts? It was a challenge because there were a lot of materials, you know, and different sources. What I really tried to do was to corroborate the different sources. So, of course, Hikayat Aceh, for example, would have lots of mythical stories about, you know, exploits of Iskandar Muda, for example, you know, the kind of titles that he had. But there were also, for example, in the Bustan, in a way, what you would call known facts that were also related in these indigenous sources. And these were corroborated by reading Dutch sources. So when these two evidences or these two information were able to be corroborated, then I think you'll be able to sort of stand on firmer ground. So, for example, if you talk about the Bustan, okay, the Bustan would mention the queen as, you know, very generous, very pious, you know, and of course it was commissioned by royalty, right? Mm-hmm. Some of the writings would appear to be very formulaic, you know, and it would be the same as, you know, the king Iskandar Thani and the Sultana, for example. But when you look at the Dutch sources and Dutch sources' description of the Sultana being pious, for example, Trautmann would describe the queen, you know, as being a very pious person. She observed the fast, that during audience days, you know, during fasting month, she would apologize that, you know, they could not serve the Dutch food, you know, and they were invited later, you know, during after breakfast for them to have feast and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So this kind of corroboration, one from the indigenous sources and one from the VOC sources, so you could be able to more or less get so-called the known facts of what happened.
I think that you have provided a really rich picture about the court of early modern Aceh. And for the listeners who may be unfamiliar, could you tell us a little about who are the main players?
If you look at Aceh in the 17th century, Aceh would more or less fit into the model of maritime Southeast Asia, insular Southeast Asia, where Aceh would almost be an entrepot port, you know, where Aceh was very much central in terms of the trading networks north of Aceh, the trading networks with the Asian traders, the Gujaratis, the Arabs, with the Red Sea, and also the Asian merchants, the Chinese merchants, the Malay merchants, who were trading in Malacca, in Java, Brunei, so on and so forth. So it was part of that global Asian trading network. But of course, with after Islamization in 13th century in Southeast Asia, you know, Pasai and Aceh would also be seen as a sultanate, as a kingdom which had a kerajaan. And of course, you know, the ruler and the ministers more or less adopting the Islamic law and adat law as well. So it was sort of seen as a Muslim sultanate. And of course, Aceh was ruled by sultan and sultanas. But generally from the Dutch sources, this is where we're able to get quite a lot of the actors who were playing very active roles at court. And these were the nobilities, which we call the Pulu Malang, would be one. And then you have the Orang Kaya, the wealthy nobility, who were also involved in the administration and politics of Aceh. And of course, the ministers themselves. You know, you have the four council ministers who were closely working with the ruler. But of course, besides these two major actors which I've mentioned, the Asian traders and, you know, the sultanate, you have the coming of the European companies in the early part of the 17th century. You have the EIC and the VOC. So it was very much these three sort of main players interacting, contesting, competing, you know, in sort of the 17th century world of maritime Southeast Asia.
It seems like a bustling hub that's sort of embedded in this network of global Asia, where you have both Asian as well as European interactions. But it's also interesting that I think, as you mentioned earlier, one of the narratives that you're writing against, so to speak, is this idea of the narrative of decline. So even amidst this sort of bustle and the activity of the age of commerce, so to speak, this is also not considered Aceh's most prosperous time in some ways. And it's and in some ways, the period of the Sultanas was not considered as part of the golden age in that sense. How do you think these sort of perceptions arise, and how does your book challenge them?
The idea of when did the sort of maritime kingdoms, you know, decline, and when did the rise of Europe and colonialism take place, is very much discussed and contested, you know, in different schools of opinions and so forth. But the received view at that time, you know, in the 17th century, was that generally there was already a decline of the maritime kingdoms because of the loss of Banten, Makassar to the European companies. And you have the increasing commercial incursions of both the Dutch especially, and then of course the EIC, and the conquest of Malacca by the Dutch. So that were some of the evidences that we used to illustrate that, you know, 17th century was sort of a crossroad for maritime kingdoms in Southeast Asia, and that showed sort of the decline of these kingdoms and the rise of Europe. I think there may be a general pattern, and of course Anthony Reed mentioned about 1680, the loss of us there. But I think the individual kingdoms were not that researched in depth to really illustrate the phenomenon of decline. So that was a question that I was very interested in as well. I mean, did Aceh decline, you know? So there is this sort of assumption and received view, but whether or not it declined, I think we need further research. And also the idea that, you know, by the late 17th century, Aceh under the Sultanas had lost the vassal states of Perak, Johor, and some of Sumatra West Coast states. So it pointed to the fact that, oh, you know, since the queens were there and, you know, they lost all these territories, so there was a decline of Aceh. So when I read most of the records, the VOC records did not go right up to the end of the 17th century, so because the Dutch sort of left Aceh in the 1660s. The EIC tried to more or less establish themselves and try to establish forts, but they were not very successful. But if you look at the travel records of the Europeans, then this is another corpus of sources which I used besides the company records and besides the indigenous records, the travel records of both Asian traders and European traders. They were really describing Aceh in the 1680s. People like Thomas Bowrey, William Dampier, they described a rich Aceh. They described an Aceh that had, you know, ships in the harbour, that had very buoyant trade, you know. And there was a network of these private traders and Asian traders. And it told a story of continuation. It told a story of resilience. It told a story of response rather than a dwindling, declining port. And Aceh remained independent until sort of the early part of the 20th century. You know, so it was more of a story of response and resilience and continuity. And based on evidences from these European traders, Aceh was still a cosmopolitan and still, you know, very thriving port. Right. So when you talk about the queens generally as well, you need to look at what was the nature of that conquest of Iskandar Muda. I mean, to what extent was he able to control these areas in the first place, and the nature of their overlord vassal relation in terms of whether or not they were actually discontinued. Just because sort of, you know, some of these vassal states sort of turned away from Aceh, it did not necessarily mean that, you know, there was a discontinuity in terms of the interactions, and that just because there was loss of territory, there was a decline in terms of the internal power and the royal authority of Aceh. This is also a matter of how you understand decline. You know, what kind of criteria do you use for you to actually describe you know, something as decline. So generally, I think maybe I look at what you mentioned just now in terms of the perceptions of these queens, you know. So they were generally deemed as weak because they were seen to have lost territories. They were seen to also be accommodative to the Dutch. But I think if you turn the whole idea of golden age, you know, what does it mean to have a country to have reached its golden age? Does it mean that you need a very strong ruler with prowess and wealth? Do you need conquests? Is that the idea of golden age? Or is it more the idea of peace? The idea of a trading hub that was able to be resilient, that was able to respond to the incursions of the VOC, and the ability to sort of still enable Aceh to be a literary center, you know, in that particular. So if you look at the idea of, let's say, style of leadership in terms of peace, in terms of accommodation, and in terms of using moral capital, social capital, soft power, perhaps, what we see today, it does not necessarily mean that it could be a decline or it is ineffective. Indeed, I would argue in my book, just as I argue in my book, that because of the very change of style of leadership, you know, away from conquest, away from this kind of prowess in terms of challenging the different companies, but this accommodation, the signing of treaties, and yet limiting, you know, the concessions that were given to the Dutch, that in a way brought about that peace and that continuity and helped Aceh to maintain their independence.
Correct.
You know, in the 17th century.
I think we will pause briefly for our sponsor's message, and when we come back, we'll discuss the role of queens in greater detail and also delve into the issue of Islam and female authority.
New Books in Southeast Asian Studies has the generous support of the ANU Southeast Asia Institute, connecting you with the Australian National University's wealth of expertise in the politics, languages, societies, and economics of Southeast Asia through research, teaching, events, and more. To get details, visit seasiainstitute.anu.edu.au. That's SE Asia Institute as one word.
Welcome back to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies. I'm with Sherbanu Han talking about her book, Sovereign Women in a Muslim Kingdom. One of the main characters in this book is Sultana Safiyatuddin Shah, who is a major ruler during this period. And she comes across, I think, as someone who is gentle and diplomatic, especially when contrasted with the kings who came just before her. How should we read this history in the sense of how much should we attribute these differences in leadership styles to gender and how much to the personality of the ruler themselves?
That was something that I was really grappling with, you know, when I was writing the thesis and also the book. What I intended to do was really to look at particular case studies. And of course, here would be Aceh in the 17th century. Aceh in the 17th century would, of course, be covering the reigns of Sultan Mukamil, Sultan Iskandar Muda, Sultan Iskandar Thani, and then the four sultanas. That's the whole 17th century Aceh. So what I tried to do was to see what were the changes, what were the continuities in terms of royal elite relations, in terms of administrative style, leadership style, you know, and the kind of policies relating to the internal politics of Aceh and also relating to the European companies. What I had in terms of comparison basically was the two kings, her father and her husband, her predecessors, and then of course her three successors. In that sense, there was really a gender element there because looking at sort of predecessor sultans and then the successor sultanas. So when I was looking at the kind of policies, the kind of elite royalty relations between these two sultans and the queens, there were distinct differences in terms of styles. Because if you look at both, and this evidence in the sources, in both the European company sources and also in the indigenous records, like if you get Hikayat Aceh, for example, it was stated, you know, that there were this kind of cruel punishments that were being meted out on the Orang Kaya and also on the people who actually were rivals or challenging, you know, the position of whether it is Sultan Iskandar Muda, Sultan Iskandar Time. And also, for example, it was stated in Dutch sources that it was quite rare that there were this kind of debates or kind of discussions during audience days about policies. It was quite rare when Iskandar Muda, for example, would call upon the Orang Kaya to come over to sort of make decisions. In fact, audience days themselves were not very regular during Iskandar Muda and Iskandar Tani's period. And these were really quite different from what the Dutch were reporting during the Sultanas. There were very regular audience days. There were many discussions, you know, about whether or not to buy certain things, because I think one chapter of my book was really talking about the jewel affair, whereby Iskandar Tani actually ordered thousands of dollars of jewelry. And when the VOC officials came, you know, with the order, he already died. You know, he just died. It was an unexpected death. So there was a whole long, almost 4 years of discussion of whether how much to buy and so on and so forth. So there were quite a lot of these episodes in terms of illustrating the kind of leadership style that Sultana Safiatuddin had, and she was the longest reigning, you know, from 1601 to 1675. So there was quite a lot of information on her reign. So when just looking at this evidence and comparing it, it did look as if there were quite distinct, you know, leadership styles. And also, I think another important point of departure perhaps would be the way they represented themselves, the way they were describing themselves in the letters. There were more similarities between Iskandar Muda and Iskandar Tani, for example, in terms of depicting themselves as the owner of elephants and horses, a lot of material emphasis on the wealth and the charisma and the prowess. Whereas if you look at the letters of Sultana Safiatuddin, quite a number of the things that she omitted, there were about 5 characteristics that she omitted from her letter. And these 5 characteristics were all pertaining to the material wealth and the prowess of the leader. Instead, I mean, she added new characteristics of describing herself. And then it was more in terms of how she would rule, you know, how she would try to deliver God's laws, for example, how she would be, in a way, a vicegerent of God, but not as sort of a representative of God, not sort of that divine kind of understanding, but more as a servant of God, and you have to look after the welfare of the people. But to say that somehow this could be a gendered style of leadership, I think that's still a question mark. Because, of course, there are pious sultans. Of course, there are really sort of Amazon-like female rulers who were aggressive and who were warlike as well. So I'm not saying that those characteristics would necessarily gender the style of leadership, you know. But from these case studies, very specific, I'm really looking at specific particular case studies, you may have resonance from that. And to add to that, I mean, there's not much study, but with the few studies that there are out there, like, for example, the Begums of Bhopal, and Professor Bradley had done a little bit on the Patani Queens. If you compare female leadership or sultanas, you could see that the characteristic of piety, the use of moral capital, the sort of ethics of care, you can say in terms of empathy. Okay, if you look at recent more studies, they would say something like transformational type of leadership as opposed to the transactional sort of more masculine type of leadership. These women seem to illustrate this type of characteristics. So it could be quite sort of distinct in that sense. To really see gendered leadership, I think more research needs to be done, more comparative evidences need to be weighed to really see whether it is gendered.
And I think it's really interesting. I just want to pick up on one aspect that you mentioned earlier about piety. And I think part of having a sort of pious personality is also part of the Sultana's charisma. And it's interesting in the book how she was accepted not just as Sultana, but also as Khalifa, I think, among the elite in Aceh. And since Islam is popularly considered to be rather unfriendly to female leadership, at least in some views. So how did Aceh Sovereign present themselves as Islamic leaders, and how effective was their presentation?
I think there is a popular conception that Islam is anathema to female leadership. In fact, I think if you look at a certain orientation of Muslims, the more patriarchal understanding of Islam and leadership, there would be a group who would say, Islam actually forbid women from leadership positions. But that would be just one orientation. And I think we need to understand Islam in a bigger context whereby, there are many orientations, whereby there are many interpretations of the role of men, the role of women, and the criteria of leadership. Generally, in my book, if you look at Southeast Asia, the role of women and status of women were quite distinct. And this is if you look at Anthony Reed's study, Barbara Andrade's study, for example, women were taking part in diplomacy, in the economy, even in warfare. Perhaps the political culture tradition of sort of Southeast Asia at that time did not disallow, or was in a way not really seen as exceptional, that if you have sort of a woman, being in a higher position, for example. Coming back to Islam, I think it is also about how much Islam was interpreted at that time, at that context. If you look at the famous ulama Abdul Rauf Al-Sinkil and also Al-Raniri, who had written the Bustan and who praised the Sultana in the Bustan Al-Salatin, the interpretation of Islam here certainly did not forbid women from being leaders. So I think you need to really understand, sort of maybe perhaps one orientation of Islam in terms of forbidding it. But also there would be many other interpretations in terms of how women are being understood using the Islamic lens in terms of being able to be leaders. And generally, how Islam was interpreted very much depended on the stakeholders of that time. And that was, in a way, how women were seen, by sort of the Muslims and the ulama in Aceh, that it was not forbidden. It was not, in fact, a gendered thing, because to them, if you look at the Tajwid Salatin, for example, they were quite different from mainstream ideas of what were the criteria of leadership. So if you look at Al-Mawardi, for example, they would, even Al-Ghazali to a certain extent, would cite manliness as a criteria for leadership, manliness in terms of being able to go to war, so on and so forth. But if you look at Malay Muslim conception here of leadership, if you look at the Hikayat, for example, it is more in terms of your manners. It's not because of your gender, it's how you behave, how you're able to help the subjects, for example. So being well-mannered and being, of course, a Muslim would be the criteria, but not so much a gendered kind of criteria in terms of how to be, or whether you could be a leader or not. And I think here, again, if you look at Islamic history, there had been women who ruled. Not as many as in Southeast Asia. And that's very interesting, because this is where I think the adat and the political culture in terms of the role of women here would play a part in terms of understanding Islam and understanding adat and the acceptance of women as rulers. But even in the past, if you look at the cartoons in Mongolia, and if you look at, let's say, Yemen, for example, although not very numerous, but there were occasions of women being sovereigns. Their names were mentioned in the khutbah, and their names were minted on the coins, and these were the signs of sovereigns. So if you look at Islamic history, and if you look at that part of Islamic history and the orientation and the understanding that, leadership did not necessarily be forbidden to women, then you'll be able to understand, even here in Islam and the context whereby these women, were able to be accepted as legitimate sovereign with the adat and, with the culture and with the individual Islam by the ulama in this part of the region, then her leadership was not only not accepted, but not only forbidden, but it was accepted as legitimate, and she was seen as a sovereign in her own right.
Yeah, I think she was, for Sultana Safiuddin particularly, she was also particularly placed in having to navigate a period of Achilles' history where there was factionalism among different religious elites. And could you tell us a bit about how she managed this sort of religious conflict?
Yeah, I think the 17th century was a time when there were different religious orientations in Aceh. And of course, it was not only during the time of the queens. It was something that she inherited. And that was what happened during the time of her father and also her husband. So there was the contestation and conflicts between the more sort of mystical understanding of Islam, as illustrated by the group with Hamza Fansuri, for example, and Shamsuddin Sumatrami. And then you have another, you could say, the more orthodox, legalistic understanding of Islam, as represented by Al-Raniri. And there was a clash between Al-Raniri and Shamsuddin Sumatrani supporters. And that brought about a lot of bloodshed during the time of Iskandar Muda. What I suggest was the involvement of the sultans in terms of supporting one faction against the other and politicizing that religious debates and orientations was very negative and politically unstable for Aceh, because that was something that was really remembered in terms of how Raniri persecuted Shamsuddin Sumatrani's faction. During the Sultanah's period, there was a possibility of this happening because with the return of another ulama, Shafu Rijal, the Dutch sources reported that quite a number of the Orang Kaya wanted to have him as the Sheikh al-Islam instead of Raniri. So there was this sort of coming again of a competition between Raniri and his supporters and Shafu Rijal and his supporters. But what the Queen did was, interestingly, not to get involved in this religious debate. She sort of stayed away and I would say did not politicize this factional struggle by supporting one against the other. So it was more of a, the Orang Kaya finally, like, perhaps almost like a consensus, or at least a majority opinion that, they would rather appoint Shaikhul Rijal, as the Sheikh of Islam. But still, she had to have the last say. And here, this is very interesting. That's why, generally I said that she was sovereign, because in most of the debates and most of the audience days, after this kind of mushawara, which was encouraged during audience days, the last say was the Queen's. So she would step in and say, okay, yes, she would agree to this, and and then they would end up by saying Daulat, that the Queen had that say. So the lack of this involvement, and supporting one faction against the other and politicizing the religious debate, staying away from this would be one way of sort of dealing with this, and that helped in establishing that kind of peace and, in a way, avoiding this kind of religious conflicts, in Aceh, as happened during the period of.
We have talked about the rise of the female sovereigns in Aceh and the way in which they also derived religious support and legitimacy. In the context of this story, how can we think or rethink about the role of Islam in maritime Southeast Asia? Is it a special religion in the Islamic world? Or do we need to move away from thinking about different binaries, for example, moderate fundamentalists or factions that appear when people talk about Islam in the region?
When you talk about Islam and Muslims, there's always complexities and, different orientations. And I think these different orientations exist even in the past and now. So it's quite difficult to say, you know, okay, at this time, you know, it's not sort of in a linear sense. It's always, there's different orientations that exist most of the time. It's only that perhaps certain orientations become more dominant, you know, depending on the context, depending on the politics and the power at that particular time. But I hope when we look at the past, when we look at the political, historical tradition of Muslims and the fact that Muslims have interpreted Islam in a very capacious manner, have interpreted Islam not in a sort of a very patriarchal or gendered manner, but to look at, let's say, for example, leadership, you know, in a different sense, not in the patriarchal understanding of that women are forbidden to rule. I think these episodes in Islamic history, in Aceh, and also in this part of the region where there was a preponderance of female rulers who were accepted. Not only female rulers, but there were female who took part in the nationalist movement. For example, Chut Nyat Den, who also fought in the Aceh War against the Dutch. I think this could serve as very important examples that could perhaps make us understand the present, you know, and also how this kind of episodes in history can also serve the future in terms of how do you understand Islam, how do you interpret Islam, and what is the role of women in Islam. I think Aceh and the history of Aceh, where women have been in power and are still having strong positions, you know, despite Sharia law and all that, would serve as a very important example that this understanding of Islam exists.
That is what makes this particular study especially valuable, I think, in highlighting the empirical basis in which we can draw this picture. And coming back, I think, to that empirical basis, what is your most surprising find in the archives when you're researching this book?
There were many surprises. I was getting to the sources with the understanding that, okay, why were these women weak? So what were the things that happened that made them weak? But the sources actually reveal a different story that, you know, they were quite critical in terms of balancing the factions in Aceh at court, you know, accommodating the Dutch, dealing with the Dutch and so on and so forth. So those were quite surprising. And that was in itself important. I mean, they didn't set out to challenge this and therefore wanted to show, you know, it was a surprise find that, you know, the women were doing this. And in that sense, you should revisit and question the whole idea about, you know, women being responsible for the decline. And, you know, just because they were women, you know, there's this idea that they had to be figureheads so that they were weak. You know, the empirical data showed otherwise. So that was a surprise find. But another thing that really struck me and sort of, in a way, I hold on the principle or philosophy of the Sultana, which I suppose reflected her personality and the values and all that. But there's this, you know, very striking bit in the letter which she sent to a Dutch governor, which in a way, not just talking about the war and all that, but she was almost sort of advising him and giving like a sermon to him by saying that, okay, you know, you should remember two things. You should remember God and you should remember death. You should forget two things. You should forget all the bad things that people do to you, and you should forget the good things that you do to people. And only that, you know, only with that, that your conscience will remain pure and calm.
Right, and that is a nice note to end off on, since you have taken so much of your time and you have shared so much inspiring findings from your book. So thank you very much, Professor Sherbanuhan. It was a pleasure to have you joining us on New Books in Southeast Asian Studies to discuss your monograph, Sovereign Women in a Muslim Kingdom, The Sultanas of Aceh, 1641 to 1699, published by Cornell University Press in 2018. And you have been listening to New Books in Southeast Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. If you have enjoyed this episode, please do check out our other episodes and join in another time.
Thank you.